March 7th, 2018, Gluck Building in YU Campus in Washington Heights. Here we are, room 308. All right, Blau, introduce him.
I don't want to take up much of Rabbi Rakefet's time, and I know you might either have to go to Shear or figure out how to deal with the snow, but it's only appropriate that someone as well-known and as committed to everything Yeshiva stands for and has taught in Agus campus for so many years, not just start speaking, but get a little bit of an introduction. Rabbi Rakefet and I were classmates in the Rav Shir, in Yeshiva College. We were in high school. We were in different high schools with two TAs, but we did have a joint project for a joint publication of some sort for all the Yeshiva University high schools. So we go back a good number of years. Rakefet has devoted his life to many things. He's done incredible work for the Jews in Russia, for the Jews in Israel, and but in particular, he's been very loyal, devoted to the Rav, the memory of the Rav. He wrote a two-volume biography of the Rav. And he came to America for the 25th Yahrzeit, even though the Yahrzeit actually is in Chol Hamoed Pesach. And we'll be speaking on the Soloveitchik family, not just the Rav. He'll tell you all the other people in the family who's connected. And the connection to Shea University, Rabbi Aaron Rakefet.
First of all, if you know a little Yiddish, I have to be off the wall to be here. I gave Shea in Gris Sunday, Monday, beautiful summer weather. At my age, I made the big exhausting trip to get here yesterday. And here I am watching snow, which I haven't seen in many years. But when YU called me, what can I do with my Rebbe's memory? And some of you might know that in my Sunday class in Gris, Shas, Peskim, Shelet, and Shuvat, I've published my last volume. My eighth volume is 370 pages on Aguna and Mamzei Rut. Two of the most, the sound is no good, there's an echo. Who's in charge? There's an echo. Again, in Israel we have better equipment. They set me up and never a problem. Okay, check that there shouldn't be an echo. So Sunday, Monday is Devah Hashem Zu Halacha, but my Monday class has always been something different. I've never repeated a lecture, neither Sunday nor Monday, from the day the Kollel opened in 78 with a formal program. So I gave 22 years on Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik. Out of three of those lectures from the 22 years came my two volumes on the Rav, and Baruch Hashem, God should spare us a lot more to be done. Now, in the lectures I'm giving here in the United States in memory of my Rebbe, I'm not repeating a lecture. If you can hear all nine of them, you'll have a much better picture of the Rav. But what I want to do today, Kavat HaMakom, is speak about the Soloveitchik family and their relationship to Yeshiva University, how it all began. It's a lot of Hashkacha Pratit here, as you will hear. In following the Civil War, East Europeans started to pour into America. Before the Civil War, you had Germans, Bavarians, Sephardic Jews, very few East Europeans. Eastern Europe was a much more primitive society, and they never heard about America. But the Civil War captured everyone's attention that brothers are killing brothers, cousins are killing cousins, and it's all over slavery. People knew there was an America. By 1870, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, ultimately millions, my wife's family, my family included, were only alive because our grandparents chose to come to America, in my wife's case, 150 years ago, in my case, 120 years ago. And thank God, Hitler couldn't reach us. Well, these Jews came to America, and very rapidly assimilation began. I'll speak about living in two worlds, which all of us live in at Stern College, Be'ezrat Hashem, present my Rebbe's guidance, how to do it. And a kid growing up in America had very little interest in religion. My classmate, our classmate, Rabbi Blau, myself, later, our classmate was a great individual. We know him as Chaim Soloveitchik. You know him as Rabbi Dr. Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav's only son. And he wrote a tremendous article, a tremendous study, Ruption, Reconstruction, which appeared in Tradition on to 30 years ago, where he describes what happened in America, a total rupture of religious observance. By the late 1870s, the Jews on the Lower East Side is where all the Jews lived, the East Europeans. Later they move out to Harlem, to the Bronx, to Brooklyn. They were very troubled. How can we get our children to remain Jewish? And they came up with the idea of following the example of the British Empire, where they had a chief rabbi. And as you know, in England, even the Jews that weren't observant, but they still had traditional feeling, the synagogue they went to was a Torah synagogue, an Orthodox synagogue, a Mechitza synagogue, and that goes on until today in England, South Africa, Australia, etc. So they liked the example of a chief rabbi, and by 1879, they chose a chief rabbi, and he agreed to come, and it's a name that all of you know. You've studied his Perush on Tanakh, the Malbim. And the Malbim was an excellent choice because for America you needed someone who was very open-minded. And the Malbim either had a doctorate, until today we can't be certain. People say he had a PhD, but he certainly had the knowledge for a PhD. However, the Gemara says in Shabbos, Ein Mazal Yisrael, if we take it literally, it means something else in the Gemara, but to take it literally, we Jews have no mazal, no luck. On the way traveling through Europe to reach the boat in Hamburg to sail for America, he was on in years, in his 70s, and he died. So that fell through, and then big machloket on the east side, who to choose. Finally, by 1886, they chose Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, a Talmud Mufak of Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, a member of the Vilna Beis Din, an outstanding orator which appealed to American Jews. And in 1887, they brought him to America dancing in Hoboken, New Jersey, where the boat docked. They went to greet him. They were overjoyed. A great rav is in America. We have a chief rabbi. Tomorrow will be wonderful. And some of you know the story with Rabbi Yaakov Yosef was great tragedy. America is America. No one can control you. It's not a conservative society. It's not like England where there's a king and a queen. In England, when you meet the queen, you have to curtsy, you have to bow. In America, I've yet to see anyone bow when he meets a President Trump, okay, or President Obama, and Daila Hakima. So Chief Rabbi of America, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, 2 weeks later, Rabbi, the Musk of a Rav, who also lived on the east side, Rabbi Vinovitz, puts up a sign. He's chief rabbi of the United States and Canada. And they ask him, who made you chief rabbi? He said, the sign painter. But you can do what you want in America. So Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, I don't want to go into all the details now. It was a sad story at the end when he died in 1902. But something else happened at that time that caught on. And that, of course, is the start of what today is Yeshiva University. A elementary yeshiva was organized on New York's east side called Eitz Chaim, so that a kid could go to school for 8 grades, and in addition to doing the general curriculum, he could learn Chumash, learn Hebrew. The classes were in Yiddish, that was the language they spoke. He could start learning Mishnah, could learn Gemara. But then a problem develops. Let's be honest, you can go to your yeshiva ketana, what you call today your day school, for 8 years, and if you don't continue, it has very little impact on you. So there was a rabbi on the east side, Rabbi Matlin, Reb Moshe Meir Matlin. He came to America with Rabbi Yaakov Yosef to be a member of his Beis Din. And he had a son, Akiva. And he wanted Akiva, when he went to high school, he wanted him to continue learning Gemara. So how do you get your kid to learn Gemara? He said, Akivala, bring two of your friends. So he brought two friends to the house. The father had candy on the table, started teaching Gemara. Soon there were 3 kids, 5 kids, 7 kids, 9 kids, 10 kids, 20 kids. Too much for the house in 1897 on the Lower East Side in a shul. A serious program began. Kids going to high school, learning Gemara after they come home 3:30, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And they gave it a beautiful name, named in memory of the Rav of Kovna, which was the most prestigious rabbinate in Eastern Europe, Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who had just died in 1896. So they named it the Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. Now, these schools continued. But right after Rabbi Jacob Joseph died, they organized a elementary yeshiva in memory of Rabbi Jacob Joseph, RJJ. It functions until today. Today, I believe, it's in Staten Island. And little by little, Yeshiva Seitz Chaim became a school for older kids. By 1915, they merged to form one yeshiva, and the name that the immigrants loved was Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, because that spoke to them. I've published a great deal on Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Spector. Those of you interested, it appears in one of, I have 8 books in circulation. Many have gone through 4 editions. I'm just a humble little kid who never grew up. I took the message of Yeshiva very seriously, Bnei Akiva very seriously, and I live in 1951. That was the day I entered the Yeshiva. Not here, this didn't exist. Block up. And I'm still breathing the air of 1951. I refuse to grow older, and I made a deal with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, no matter what age I die at, but I'm still in 51. Be'olam hazeh and be'olam haba be'ezrat Hashem. So they merged and formed Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. Now, believe it or not, as these American kids matured and acculturated, became part of the American scene, they wanted a high school. They wanted an education. And the board of trustees of the yeshiva, consisting of East European immigrants who made some good money in America, wholesale business, retail business, real estate, they didn't want a high school. And this is all documented. You can read about it in Rabbi Dr. Gil Klapperman's work on the yeshiva and in my first book, Bernard Rebel, Builder of American Jewish Orthodoxy. And these members of the Board of Trustees said, we make a good living in America. We darf nicht haben English. We don't need English. It's good enough for us. We give money to the yeshiva, and we want the boys just to learn Torah. They're busy making money, but we want them, yesach v'zvul, and they have to learn Torah. The rabbis were smarter, and they understood there has to be a general program because America requires it. You're going to go out to the world. Everyone is a high school graduate. Who do they get to head up to high school? And here was a miraculous story that we'll leave for another time. And Greenhorn came to America in 1906. Imagine as he was walking through the customs officials being let into America, Bernard Revel. Imagine if they would have told this greenhorn who barely knew English, Rabbi Revel, in 1986, when the yeshiva celebrates 100 years of its existence, remember I told you Eitz Chaim began 86? 1986, 100 years, the United States government is going to issue a stamp in your honor with your picture. And there's a $1 stamp, the Bernard Revel Memorial Stamp. You can use that on any letter that requires $1 postage. If you don't believe me, go to Bernard Revel Graduate School and ask them to show you a picture of the stamp. If you later study with me in Gris asked me to bring the stamp into class and show it to you. So Bernard Revel came to America, knew all of Shas and Paiskim, a photographic memory. His father had been Prener Rav, very close to Rav Yitzchak Chanan Spektut, was a suburb of Kafna. And the rabbi of Philadelphia, Rabbi Leventhal, meets him on the Lower East Side in Yeshiva Shabbos Chanan and says, in America, you know Shas and Paiskim, you need college education. Within a few years, he graduates NYU. He goes on to what's today part of the University of Pennsylvania, Dropsy College. He is the first PhD graduate of Dropsy College, which today is the Postgraduate School of Semitic Studies, I believe it's called, at the University of Pennsylvania. He marries, does a proper shidduch with a girl with a PhD, only her PhD stands for Papa Has Dough. That's the Travis family. They were in the oil business in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And Rabbi Revel goes into the business. He's in the oil fields at 4:30 in the morning. You have to work before the sun comes. It gets very warm. By 11 o'clock, he's back home, takes a nap, and he learns Shas Paiskim writes Kiddushei Torah. They pleaded with him, come to New York and organize MTA, Manhattan Talmudical Academy, the school which I proudly graduated, and Rabbi Blau, our brother institution, BTA, Brooklyn Talmudical Academy, which is a later development, but originally begins TA, Talmudical Academy. He reorganizes the yeshiva. It becomes more formal with a real curriculum. And 1919, the first American kids get smicha from the yeshiva. And it was a great celebration, including one graduate, Rabbi Sol B. Friedman, who later was the rabbi of Young Israel of Washington Heights. And what made Rabbi Sol B. Friedman unique? Born and bred in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So that here you have the first rabbinic graduate of Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Kohanan, who is born and bred in the United States. Today, you take it for granted, the whole yeshiva is in English, but Amol Alts is given Yiddish, and here's an American kid. Okay. Now, the East European people living in America, occasionally Rabbanim came in to visit America, they always had this attitude, an American yeshiva, what the heck is it worth? We in Europe learned much more, knew much more. There's an American institution, what kind of rebbeim, what kind of kids? So Rabbi Revel, let's be honest, what makes a yeshiva a yeshiva? Talk about Gris Kollel. Nobody comes to Gris because the facilities are like the Waldorf Astoria, I can assure you, they're not. No one comes to Gris today. They don't even feed the students in Gris. You have to hustle on your own. Alex, am I right? Alex is benching, I see. Okay, you have to hustle on your own. But what makes Gris Gris? It's faculty. Baruch Hashem, outside of your humble servant, we have world-famous teachers. Good. The Rebbe makes the school. And it's the fact. What made Lakewood Lakewood, the Baron Cutler? What tells when it was on top of the world, it was the Alta Tells of Rosh Yeshiva, the Reb Yosef Elio Bloch, Reb Matul Katz. What a world then. Rabbi Revel had one dream, to get a Europäische Rosh Yeshiva second to none, who would be willing to come to America, not to visit, not just to raise funds for Europe, but to give the shir, to be a Rebbe, to teach in Yeshivas of Solchanan. I don't know if you're aware of it here, but September 1st, YU should give a tremendous kiddush, pizza, forget about pizza, every type of beautiful cake and drink, and bring in caterers from Israel who know how to prepare and feed and everything glop kosher, nothing to worry about. Why is September 1st so important? Come with me back to 1922, a boat docked at Battery Park, and a man got off that boat, a legendary figure. Again, I've written a monograph on him. It appears in, I believe it's Rakafet Aharon Chelik Aleph. His name, Reb Shlomo Lipalachek. Make believe you've heard the name, so the ignorant pass for the wise. He was known as the Mechit Eloi, Mechit. When he was a little kid, his father brought him at the age of 12 to Volozhin. The Rosh Yeshiva and the Netziv got angry. What is this? We're babysitters in Volozhin, 12 years old. The father pleaded, get mafaher, give him a test. So the Netziv, to get rid of him, called in his grandson-in-law, who you've heard the name, Reb Chaim Brisker, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, and said to Reb Chaim, give him a test. Reb Chaim asked the kid, what do you know? The kid says, I know nothing. So how can I test you? So Reb Chaim says, you know what? This is the Daf Gemara I'm saying a shir on today. Learn the Daf. We'll talk in an hour from now. Reb Chaim comes back an hour later. Reb Chaim says to the kid, do you have any questions? The kid asks every question Reb Chaim is going to ask in the shir. And he gets, what new was Fat Fenfitman? What's your answer? And the kid answered better than Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim had to adjust the shir because the kid was better than Reb Chaim. He goes on to become Reb Shlomo Palachek. You have no idea who he was. I'm privileged that at times I was sandak to britat of his great-great-grandchildren in Israel. He was Zaycha, has endless descendants living in Israel. One time the Israeli army, I had served in the army for many years, so the chief general Navon calls me that he's running a course for the Rabbanut, and someone applied from Yeshiva University, Solomon Palachek, living in Rehovot. So he says, do you know him? I say, no, but I know already who his grandfather was. Take him. 2 months later, I get a call from the rabbi, the chief rabbi, General Navon. He says, Ata yodeya mi haya hachi tov, hachi metzuyan, mispar echad, b'kol ha-kurs. Hachaver shelcha, Shlomo Palachek. And he asked me, do you have anyone else to recommend like that? I said, listen, the Mechit Eloi was one of a kind. This is his grandson in Rehovot. The students loved him. I'm limited by time. I could tell you endless stories. I'll give you one little story. The newspapers came to see Yeshiva was having a convention of its rabbinic alumni. It's the mid-20s, the roaring 20s. And they had a caterer come in, not with pizza, a caterer with all kinds of food and luxuries and cakes. And no student is at the food. Now I want to ask you, yeshiva boys don't eat. Rebani Shlomai, so all of you walk in and right away the pizza. All right, Baruch Hashem. I hate the things you came to get the pizza, not to hear a kefet, but all right, that's the reality. Kid, no one's near the food. And they reported sitting in the corner was this Jew with a long beard, talking and learning. 80, 90 Rabbanim, American kids, graduates of the yeshiva, students in the yeshiva, were standing around to catch every word. He was a sugyan yevamot. And only when the Rebbe finished, an hour and a half later, did everyone wake up and see this food. And this was the Shlomo Lipalachek. But we Jews, again, have no muscle. In 1928, he took ill. He was in his mid-50s. An illness that today we cure with one shot of penicillin, osteomyelitis of the gum, an infection in his gum. It went to his brain, died. Rabbi Rebel was heartbroken. Who can he get to replace him? And here, Rabbi Rebel was told Reb Moshe Soloveitchik was interested in leaving Europe. I'll come back to why in a minute. But again, we deal with anti-Semitism. Nothing has changed in the world. Poland remains Poland, remains Poland, if you're up to the latest news. Reb Moshe was in Warsaw. To get to America, he had to get a visa. And the Poles and the American ambassador were anti-Semites. And Reb Moshe had had an ingrown toenail operation. So they refused to give him a visa. He come back in a year and a half. In our books it says a kveis, 18 months have to pass after an operation. And Reb Moshe could not at that time get the visa. To Rabbi Revel's mazel, at that moment in time, a great European Rosh Yeshiva was in America raising funds for his yeshiva, Reb Shimon Shkop. Some of you may know the name. Here, if you don't want to believe me, pictures from that period don't lie. I'm saying this, some right-wing people try to deny this ever happened. Pictures appear of Shimon Shkup in my work on Revel, and it could be in other publications of mine as well. And Reb Shimon, the only yeshiva that Rabbi Revel attended, he was autodidactic. One half year, one semester he spent in Telz. Who was his Rebbe in Telz? Reb Shimon Shkup. So he went to Reb Shimon and asked him to teach at the yeshiva. Reb Shimon taught here 28, 29. There's the famous picture of Reb Shimon sitting in front of the main academic center building, as we called it in my time, that I think called the Zussman building, if I'm not mistaken. And Reb Shimon was so happy here, overjoyed. But he couldn't remain. The Chafetz Chaim and Reb Chaim Moyzer sent him a letter, which the second president of Yeshiva, Reb Shmuel Belkin, told me he saw with his own eyes. He was a Talmud of Reb Shimon. And it ordered Reb Shimon back to Europe, because without you, the Yeshiva in Grodno is falling apart. So Reb Shimon left. Again, Rabbi Belkin was desperate. There were a few months when there was no one here. And finally, December 31st, 1929, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik gives his first shiur in the yeshiva in the Harry Fishel Beis Medrash. The Soloveitchik family has arrived. Do me a favor, a cup with water. I'll wait for you to come back. I'm not going to go further. No, you're doing me a favor, Slona Imli. Reb Shimon Shkup, again, in some of the Art School is a wonderful addition to Judaism, except in their historic volumes. They are unreliable, which is very sad. It is intellectually dishonest when you don't tell the truth. I'm a Talmud of Rav Soloveitchik. Maybe Rabbi Blau will agree with me. We grew up under the Rav. There was nothing worse than intellectual dishonesty. You could eat chazer on Yom Kippur and save part of it to put in bread on Chol Hamoed Pesach, but it wasn't the equal. Of course, when you do a sin, you can do tshuva. But intellectual dishonesty, remember the words, Rav, afadobnkeit, it's the whole personality is ruined. And when you can be intellectually honest, it goes right down the line. I can tell you stories in Israel of intellectual dishonesty with raising children, and it's frightening. But Reb Shimon was at the yeshiva. It is rumored. I hope it isn't true. It is rumored. As you recall, about 2 years ago, an unbelievable find appeared on the Torah scene. Some university down south that had all the movies made for the movies in the 20s, the 30s, where they used to show news on the movie screen. And they uncovered a movie of the Chafetz Chaim coming to the Knesiyah Gedolah in 1923. I can tell you to see, it's online, anyone can find it. I left it as a permanent part. Whenever I want to be inspired, I view that movie again of the Chafetz Chaim, and the way he dressed, everyone around him in formal clothes, and the Chafetz Chaim in simple clothes. It is rumored, Shkayach, Baruch Ato Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Shehakol Nieh B'Dvaro. It is rumored that they have a movie of Reb Shimon Shkup teaching at the yeshiva, and they refuse to release it because they don't want the world to know that Reb Shimon taught at yeshivas for Tzidkel Kochanan. Okay, coming back now, just where we left off, why was Reb Moshe interested, anxious to come to America? And here there's a repeat of the Meitzer Te'ili. Why did the Meitzer Te'ili come to America? Because these individuals became Mizrachiites, religious Zionists. The Meitzer Te'ili, totally religious Zionism. He was the Rosh Yeshiva in the Lida Yeshiva before World War I. It was destroyed by World War I. It was founded by the president of Mizrahi, the founder of Mizrahi as well, Reb Yitzchak Yaakov Reines. The yeshiva in Lida was Torah and Dat, they called it, but Dat in the sense of what we call Torah Umada today. And it was very uncomfortable to be open-minded in Europe. Europe was all the Rosh Yeshiva, Hasidic Rebbeim, 90% were Judaism. You're going to be open-minded? And Reb Shlomo Palachek was happy to come to America. Later in life, the Mira Rosh Yeshiva, Reb Lazy Yehuda Finkel, was in America raising funds, and he met the Mechita and said to him, Shlomo, why did you leave Europe? You'd be the most famous Rosh Yeshiva today. And the Mechita answered, yeah, that's maybe correct, but I still have to live in America because of my hashkafas. With Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, there was a long period. He himself grew up in the home of Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim was opposed not just to Zionism, not just to Mizrahi. Reb Chaim was opposed to Agudat Yisrael. But we'll leave that for some other time to go into detail. Reb Moshe was just like his father. But there's an expression in French which comes from the Midrash Rabbah, Hakol Acharei Ha'isha. The woman you marry has a great influence on you. Adam, right or wrong? And he married Rebbetzin Pesher Feinstein, who I yet knew. I believe Rabbi Blau can tell you he yet knew her. I yet knew her. And she came, she was a first cousin to Reb Moshe Feinstein. Her father was Tuzhana Rav, Rebellia Feinstein. But they were much more open. The family was much more open. And they were related to Katznelenson, one of the big founders of what later becomes the Mapai in Israel. And they had a broader vision. And over the years, she influenced her husband, and the facts of life in Europe influenced him. They ran away when the communists take over. They ran to Poland. They're lucky, read the memoir of the Rav's sister, Shulamit Meiselman. They're lucky they got there in one piece. In Poland, the anti-Semitism afterwards. And he was happy to come to America. And he found himself in this very neighborhood. He davened up the block in a shul, which today is later became a yeshiva, named in his memory, Yeshivat Rabbeinu Moshe Soloveitchik. It doesn't exist today. The building is part of Yeshiva University. Yeshivat Rabbeinu Moshe Soloveitchik in Washington Heights, and Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yisrael Salanter in the Bronx were the two main feeder schools for Talmudical Academy. When we went to TA, and even when Rabbi Blau went to BTA, the main part of the student body in MTA was Salanter graduates, Soloveitchik graduates. Brooklyn, of course, was different. No kid from Salanter or Soloveitchik is going to go to BTA. They had their own feeder schools. But here, and Reb Moshe was very happy, had Talmidim, had a place, had a home. One of his great Talmidim just died a few weeks ago. One of the last of the Talmidim, if not the last, maybe one of the very, very last, Rabbi Dr. Gilbert Klapperman, the rabbi of Beth Shalom in the Five Towns. He was a Talmid of Reb Moshe. Oh, it's a who's who in Torah history, the Talmidim of Reb Moshe. Now, while Reb Moshe was here at Yeshiva, his eldest son, he had five children, he and Rabbi Hana, Rabbanit Pesha, they had five children. The eldest son, Mori Urebi Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, he already had a much broader vision. They say that the Torah of risk he got from his father, the breitkeit, the broadness, he got from his mother. And he sought out higher education in Berlin. And this itself is a frightening fact of history, that here is the Rav going to Berlin. Berlin, the greatest center of Western culture. The Rav went there. No, help me out. Who else went there? The Lubavitcher Rebbe, Reb Yitzchak Kuttner, Professor Avram Yehoshua Heschel, the Kapitznitzer Rebbe's son, later at the seminary. the greatest woman to live in the 20th century. No, give me her name. Professor Nechama Leibovitch. Who else went there? Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg. We're talking giants upon giants. The Sri Deyesh, Reb Chaim Keller. Wow, wow, wow. And as the Rav said, could you imagine within 10 years some of my very professors were devotees and advocates of Hitler, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro. It's unbelievable. So don't let the lure of the Western world overpower you. This was Berlin. But the Rav was there. It was a very important experience for the Rav. I would like to give a lecture. It seems there's no time while I'm in New York. But I would like to give a lecture on the Rav's years in Berlin. I've done a lot of research. I've walked the streets of Berlin with the Rav. And I was privileged yet to talk and work and walk the streets of Jerusalem with people who walked the streets of Berlin with the Rav and knew him intimately. And the Rav gets his PhD, meets a nice young lady in Berlin who also gets a PhD, and they're ready to get married back in Vilna, 31. Now, I'm going to tell you something which I cannot swear is a fact, but I'm 99% certain my educated guess is correct and very interesting. The Rav once gave a talk. It's recorded that one day will appear. There are a lot of talks of the Rav circulating. One day this will all be available to the public, I trust, in organized form. It may not be in 25 years, but in 50 years. Okay. The Rav gave a talk on the efficacy of prayer, whether prayer can achieve something. And the Rav, one of the ideas he stressed is, do not think that if God doesn't answer your prayer, that it's dafka, not good. Sometimes the greatest blessing you can have is when God does not answer your prayer. And the Rav said, and this was a number of times, I believe my colleague Rav Heschel Schechter mentions it in one of his books too, that the Rav said, I once wanted a rabbinic position and I prayed so hard and I cried and I prayed and my prayers were not answered. And in retrospect, it's a miracle my prayers were not answered, because had God answered my prayers, I'm calling the Rav now, I wouldn't be here, my wife wouldn't be here, my children wouldn't be here. Now what's the Rav talking about? Okay, this is the Rakefet thesis. Just as the Rav was getting smicha, getting married, 1929, actually, his uncle died. His uncle, Rabbi Nachman Karakovsky, who some of you have to know as the Avodat HaMelech, very unique Volozhin graduate, Rabbi Nachman Karakovsky was a member of the Beit Din of Vilna. He was the Magid Meshurim. Again, I can't go into detail. Everything I'm touching upon, I can lecture for hours. But in Vilna, there was no chief rabbi. That was going back to the time of the Vilna Gaon. They made a takana, we don't have a chief rabbi, we just have a Beit Din. So in Vilna there was a Beit Din headed up by Reb Chaim Moshe Grzynski. He had one dayan in charge of kashrut, another dayan was the Magid Meshurim, had to know how to speak. It's not like America where to be a rabbi you have to know how to preach in public. In Europe, a Rav had a paskin and a shaila, that's all that counted. But you had to have a Magid Meshurim if there was a big funeral in town, between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and if Pesach, someone should speak. It is my feeling that the Rav desperately wanted to inherit his uncle's position. There were family connections. Karakovsky, the Rav, the families went back a long way. Reb Menachem was married to Kesha's sister, Badana, to the Rav's mother's sister, also a Feinstein. And the members of the Vilna Beit Din and others were a little bit suspicious. The Rav, a PhD, Berlin, they didn't select him. He lost. And as a result, he had only one place to go, to join his father in America. Thank God he wasn't elected, or he would have been another statistic in the Holocaust, as Badana was. Reb Menachem Karakovsky's widow perished in the Holocaust with the manuscript of the rest of the Avodat HaMelech and all of the Rambam, not just the start, which we have, never found after the Shoah. Now, how do you get to America? you need a non-quota immigrant visa. This is after the Immigration Act of 21, which went into effect in 22. East Europeans couldn't get in. The quota was filled for years to come. You had to have an invitation inviting you to do something that no other American could do. Reb Moshe prevailed upon, this is history, it's factual, it's unbelievable. Chicago could have been the capital of American Torah. Chicago. There was a yeshiva there, what you call Skokie today. Then it was called the Hebrew Theological College. And they invited the Rav to become Rosh HaYeshiva. They brought him to America, 1932. And living right across the street with his parents, a half minute from here, and they get a telegram from Chicago. Dear Hagon Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, we kept our word, we brought your son, it's the Depression, we have no money, we can't honor the contract, find a rabbinate for him on the East Coast. And Reb Moshe goes to work, and it turned out in Boston there was a big machlokes over kashrut. Unfortunately, and in the middle of the controversy, one of the prominent rabbanim of Boston, of Avram Abba Krieger, dies of heart attack. A man in his 50s. I have two of his direct descendants sitting in my class in Yerushalayim, in Gris. They're not actually in the Kollel. They're outsiders who come to hear the Shiurim. And now Boston needs a Rav. And that's how Moreinu V'Rabbeinu, the Rav, winds up in Boston. He goes to Boston, an immigrant, a greenhorn, a command of English already, but not what's going to happen later when he becomes a master of English. Spends a good 12, 13 years as the official Rav. At that time, it was not a single shul. A number of Yerupayish shuls would get together and bring a rabbi. They didn't pay a salary, but you made a living out of hespedim you gave, money before Purim, mechirat chametz, not a happy living. Kashrut supervision. And the Rav did not have easy years in Boston. Very difficult years. Again, look into my second volume, The Silver Era, look into my work on the Revel, you know what I'm talking about. Very difficult years. His father was very upset. He was a young man, a gonadir. What the heck is he wasting his time in Boston building a day school for little kids? Maimonides, 35. The Rav used to go in and teach the kids what a lulav and etrog is. Could you imagine? He had school on Chol HaMoed Sukkos, which they tell me continues until today, because he wanted the kids to see a sukkah and to see a lulav and etrog. And Rav Moshe is desperate. They want him to do something with his mind. And in the late 30s, he turns to Rabbi Revel, and they make a contract. Published it as well, and they open up a branch of the yeshiva, a kollel in Boston. It probably is the first kollel in the United States, and a lot of Talmidim who studied in Europe, in the Europäische Yeshiva, the American-born who came to America, and a few Europeans, they all went up to Boston to study with the Rav. And the Rav then was in his prime. He was, there's stories I've heard, people who learned with him. He could wake you up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I have an answer to the difficult Rambam we dealt with yesterday. I couldn't sleep. And everyone was there to hear the answer. He became very close to a relative, Rabbi Yechiel Michel Feinstein, who was his Talmud Mufak and later marries the Brisker Rav's daughter in Israel. That's the famous Rabbi Feinstein. It's a nephew to Rav Moshe. It's a cousin to the Rav. And suddenly, in the middle of all this new dramatic development, again, Ein Mazal Yisrael. Within 7 weeks, the yeshiva is decimated. Rabbi Revel dies of Agmas Nefesh, 55 years of age. The depression, the money problems, the Hitler, the people pleading to get to America. Kislev Bet, December 2nd, 1940. The end of January, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik dies suddenly. And big debate in the yeshiva, who will succeed Reb Moshe? Many want the Rav, others say, no, he's a European, he's involved with Kashrut and Boston, and they go to Harabanim. And finally, they give the Rav a one-year contract. And at the end of the year, they say, we will meet again and decide whether we will hold on to you. This is all documented in my work on the Rav, and you'll hear it in the documentary that God privileged me to bring into the world, The Lonely Man of Faith. And the Rav gives his first year in yeshiva, right across the street, May 1941, on a Sugyam Baba Batra, Otiot Niknot B'Mesira. When you give a shtah, you owe me $50, I have a shtah, I want to give it to you to collect from him, how do I give it to you? How do you make a kinyan? Otiot Niknot B'Mesira. That was the Rav's first year. I need not tell you, he came to the class. He had other ideas, he had other dreams. He was a young man. When you're a young man, you have dreams. You understand? Believe it or not, he wanted to be the second president of the yeshiva. He fought bitterly. There were two candidates. Snoo, do you know? Rabbi Dr. Leo Young and Rabbi Dr. Joseph B. Soloveitchik. The cynics used to say if Rabbi Young is elected, he was a Yekka, Hungarian-German, there'll be no yeshiva left. And if the Rebbe is elected, there'll be no college left. That's what was said in the street. But they fought each other, supporters. And finally, in 43, they saw it's a dead end. They elected a dark horse, a youngster, 31 years of age, Reb Shmuel Belkin. Ah, thank God the Rebbe was not elected. Could you imagine what would have become? And Dr. Belkin has great zchuyot. It's a shame that a doctorate has not been written on him. I complain, and I have no, everyone that laughs at Rakefet ain't malasot. He said to the Rav, they knew each other very well. The Rav's friends called them Bedel. He said to the Rav, Bedel, I'll say it in English, but I'm thinking it in Yiddish, you have only one thing to do in the yeshiva, to teach. I'll worry about the money. And this is how the Rav became the Rav. He never had to raise money, never had to get involved in politics. All he had to do was walk into his classroom, which 102, it's now split in half. One classroom began with 15 students, later 20, 25. In our time, I went into the Rav's year, Jerry and I went in 57, right? 57, all right, there were 35 students in the class. By the way, in the next volume of Rakefet Aron, I've done something which I can't believe how much I've succeeded. There's a famous picture of the Rav teaching. That's our class. I've identified everyone in the picture outside of two students who were totally blocked. Everyone. I identified another one a few months ago, Moshe Qualbin. They said, that's him. They showed me his head and back. That's Moshe. And it was checked with him. It's talked to him. And we're going to have the whole picture in the book with everyone identified. And someone, if you fellas are smart, you'll come out with a very sophisticated scholarly work, The Class of 1960 Revisited. What each student became. You have the right wing there, the centrist, the left wing, sitting in one class. They're all Rabbanim today, but they were my class. Saul Berman, Heshi Schechter, Aaron Lichtenstein, Jerry Blau, Abba Brandspiegel, one after another, from one class. What became the Class of 1960 Revisited? It will be a fascinating scholarship, and a credit to the Rav that he could be a Rebbe to so many different types of people. That's how the Soloveitchik family arrived, and the Rav then becomes the dominant personality in Yeshiva University. He spoke time and again, this is the place that he can identify with. The Rav did not retreat from the Western world. He lived in the Western world, but he lived with Torah and brisk and learning and the Litvish heritage, but with the configuration of the Western reality. And this was the yeshiva. And he said, more than the yeshiva owes me, I owe the yeshiva. It made me into what I am today. The challenge of the students. You understand what you had here in the Rav's classroom? The brightest kids from the United States who wanted to learn Torah on a high level. The challenge, we were bright kids, not like today. We're old people today. But what? We're old and young today. I don't want to put myself all the way in the old class, or Alex will testify I'm a little young too. But what do Chazal say? B'mei churpi, when charifut, when you're young, the mind is sharp. Wow, all right, I didn't know one millionth of what I know today, but the sharpness was there. And we challenged the Rav. He couldn't get away. He set a shear. We could shoot him down. You know the legendary stories. He'd fly off the handle, put the kid, and then he'd go looking for the kid and the greasy spoon across the street to apologize. Du bist richtig. You're right. I was wrong. And the next day, he'd give a different shear. The next week, totally correct himself. It was amazing, the intellectual honesty. They arrived. Then Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, the youngest brother of the Rav. Oh, what an individual. To have known Rabbi Aaron, and Rabbi Blau worked for him in Chicago. I was very close on a personal level. Very different than the Rav. Rabbi Aaron was the reincarnation of his mother. The Rav was more his father. Rabbi Aaron was the reincarnation of Reb Chaim. The Rav was the Beit HaLevi. I trust you know what I'm talking about. Ah, Rabbi Aaron, azah ziskeit of a human being, and what a world of knowledge. And he was a lawyer. But Rabbi Aaron, when he got excited, he stuttered, he couldn't speak. Could you picture him in a court of law? But you know how he supplemented his income when he was at Chaim Berlin? He wrote the briefs for the lawyers that had to appear in court. And he could quote, like Shelton Shivet that I teach, I just in the middle of Rav Avadja with his new volume, it's unbelievable, with Mamzeret, volume 11 of Yabi Omer, which just came out. So you give this source and this precedent and that. Rav Aaron knew every law had a Goynish Kup, so the lawyer would come into court, the judge would be overwhelmed. But who wrote the brief with all the sources? That was Rav Aaron. In addition, the Rav's other brother came to yeshiva. Rav Shmuel Soloveitchik, Professor Soloveitchik, our chemistry professor. We bothered him more out of class about his family than anything going in class. You follow me? Who is it? All right, I did well in chemistry. I have a letter from him. It was a pleasure having you as my student. I got an A in chemistry. Who was interested in chemistry? I was interested in the friendship out of class that we can bother him about his father, about his mother, about his brothers, about his sisters, and get all the stories out of him. And we became very close. When Malka and I married, he, Reb Shmuel, and his wife, Batsheva, a lady became my neighbor in Israel, where after her first husband died, made a Sheva Brachas for us during our week of celebration. So you see, all three brothers taught at yeshiva. Then you take the next generation. Look at the Rav son-in-law, our classmate. I mean, we still, for me, I shake and shiver when I mention Rabbi Lichtenstein's name. Baki in Kala Torah Kula. The Rav didn't have a memory like Rabbi Aaron, right or wrong. The Rav knew the Gemara, he could quote a Gemara. And he would turn, Rabbi Aaron sent the Aaron, Avu Shteit, where is this Gemara? What daf? And in all the years I sat in front of the Rav, only once was Rabbi Aaron off. He was off by half a daf. It was an Avei Psachim. Rabbi Aaron said it's Kuf Aleph Amid Bet, and that line was the start of Kuf Bet Amid Aleph. You follow? That's the only Rabbi. And then, all right, what? And now you take Rabbi Meir Twersky. How many of you is Talmidim? This is a grandson. And how many of you have studied, what the Rav did in Israel? People say Rav Kefid has given 1,001 lectures why the Rav didn't go in Aliyah. I got to make a living, so I have topics to talk about. Baruch Hashem. But the truth of the matter is, the Rav's family and Talmidim had an unbelievable impact on the state of Israel. Every Chesda Yeshiva today is on a higher level of learning because of Rabbi Lichtenstein. He raised the entire level. You talk about Moshe Tversky, Hashem Yikom Damo, it should be, I just spoke about it, but Monday I gave a whole share of Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. What a price these Gedolim paid. That's his great-grandchildren who were massacred 2 years ago already, 3 years ago. Time flies. And who would ever dream Reb Moshe, the Reb spoke once, his first grandson. I always quote to my wife what the Reb said in the 50s. Who would ever dream that he would die in a massacre in Hanov? But wow, and then the Reb's not just the family, but the Reb's Talmidim. I cannot start to describe how we revolutionized Torah study via Israel to the Western world. And we can't thank the Rav enough, this young man born and bred in Europe, a grandson of Rav Chaim Brisker, and to be an einikel, to be a grandson. The Hasidic world is fabulous. You've inherited a mantle automatically, for better or for worse. But in the literature world, at times it can be a burden to be Reb Chaim's Aneinikel. Not so simple. And look how the Rav achieved what the Rav became and how he was able to, I don't want to use the word synthesize, because the Rav was opposed to a synthesis. He said it's not real. A synthesis involves compromise. And the Rav was opposed. But I use the word how they could coexist. So harmoniously, harmonious coexistence. We never struggled. We could become gedolim in Torah and yirat shemayim and dedication, and concomitantly get our formal general education, advanced degrees, go out into the world, and whatever profession, wherever we wanted to go, we were able to achieve, to influence, and above all, to remain, I trust, total Torah Jews. And I'll end off with a true story from Rabbi Avadja Yosef. Rabbi Avadja lived originally around the corner from us, block and a half, 2 blocks away. We live on Rav Berlin, he lived on Hanasi. And I had the schut later to teach his daughter. Now, to teach his daughter in Michlalau is not an easy mission, because if you know the history of Rav Avadja, his concept originally of what a woman should learn is to be a seamstress. His eldest daughter, who's become famous for rocking the boat and demanding education for women, he was insistent that she become a seamstress. Later, she went to the Shankar School of Design, following through with being a seamstress, took it a few steps higher. But that was Rav Avadja's concept. And here he has a daughter who not only doesn't want to be a seamstress, but wants to be part of the religious Zionist world. And he was worried. I'm quoting him word by word from private conversation. And she teaches in Michlala, among them a guy named Rakefet. He was overwhelmed by what we did for her, the level of Ashayurim, the Yirat Shemayim, and I have many reprints from him with dedication on it. And later in life, he helped me, if you're familiar with my 7th volume, Washington, Ptlahatira Naguna, we're known in the world, everyone said, Rakefet, terrific Svara, but show it to Rav Avadja. Only when Rav Avadja took it on and agreed with me, it went further halacha l'maisa. And Rav Avadja, first time he's going to America, it wasn't the famous Rav Avadja today. It was a different Rav Avadja. First time he's going to America. So I remember he asked me some questions, and he came back, and he was overwhelmed. He said, I'll say it in English, but I'm living it in Hebrew. Wherever I went, they listed out cities. I met medical doctors, lawyers, business people, successful, and they're all learning Shiurim on the highest level. And he would ask them, where are you from? And inevitably, they would tell Midim, Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik. And I could see how impressed Rav Avadya was. And this is the Rav, this is Yeshiva University, this is the Kesher to the Soloveitchik family. Halacha L'maisa, when you walk out of here, next September 1st, demand celebrations on the Wilf campus. That was the day the Mechita arrived in America. The Mechita's arrival makes the Soloveitchik saga possible, and we all benefit and will continue to benefit. L'hadil Torah, l'hadil. Thank you very, very much. I apologize. I just want to explain to the people listening in Israel, the young men sitting before me have a problem you've never dreamt about, how to get home in this snow that is falling unbelievably rapidly at this moment. So be happy in Israel that your only problem is when President Trump visits, they shut down all the streets. Are there any questions? Okay. Alex,
yeah. Do you do this every semester?
Do what?
Come and give a shiur like this. And have it be not just here in Gluck 307, have it be something that is a big, grand event so that people can actually start, you know,
advertise
well in advance, with posters.
You're talking, Alex.
Rosh Yeshiva and the president will come, and it will be an announced event that you're the only person who represents the Adam 2 aspects of the Rav, and who's developed a unique genre of Torah history, like I'm working on Torah philosophy, continuing the Rav, and inspired by you.
Alex. Good, Alex.
We need what you contribute. We need
Stop the Hesper.
Can't hide in Gross. We need you.
No one knows who I am outside of Gross.
I know. That's what I'm saying. We need to correct that.
You have no idea. They don't even list me on the REITs faculty here. You have no idea. They could raise money on my good name, but even that they don't understand. I'll tell you a good story that happened to me today. I have students all over, and I'm very close. Certain students have bonded over the generations. So I'm talking with a very important person. Let him remain nameless. Someone I greatly respect because I've seen him handle pikuach nefesh situations fabulously. So I'm going to tell you now, I was ashamed to tell my wife. So he says to me, I'm a no youngster, and to shoot out of Israel, I work hard in Israel. Not, you know, the teaching, the writing, the learning, the research, and we have a tremendous kanayin hara. I can fill this room with family, and imodel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, direct descendants, and they're very close to us. So he says to me, I hope they brought you business class. Ay, thanks. So I said to him, Chalavai, I could have slept on the plane and been relaxed. I said, no, they told me their policy is with the, you know, the mass population, what do they call it, tourist class. One thing I forced them, and my feet have gone on me, you know, age, meniscus, etc. So it was, thank God, tourist plus. I had 2 inches more for my feet. So the conversation ended that when we bring you, it is business class. So I said, Adarabha. But okay, Alex, I appreciate your kind words, but that's life. I've made my peace with Baruch Hashem. No one knows I know anything outside of it. I'm ruined. Everything one says, oh, yeah, you're a professor of Jewish history. Of course, you know Jewish history. Doesn't mean you can't know Shas, Paiskim, Shelet, and Shuvat, Rebbeinu Shalom, what we did in class. Okay.
It's not just Jewish history you teach. It's not just facts. You create the experience. You give us a window into the personalities.
Right.
You help us access the experiential parts of these personalities, the context that they lived in we're missing it. It's something important.
What can I say?
You're the only person that has it.
All right, but I do my share. It's recorded, and I have another volume coming out before the summer. Very important volume. The first 100 pages on the Vah Hashem Zu Halacha, dealing with Hafkat Kedusha. You follow? Then I have two chapters that they cut out of Washington because they didn't want the book to be so big. It was 530 pages, so there will be another 100 pages. Now, these chapters are very precious to me, and a student already pledged a tremendous amount of money to cover it, putting them in properly with proper pictures. I'll tell you why. Our work in Russia, in retrospect, was, I don't want to say the most important aspect of our lives. It was not. I have something more important, but that's not for now. It's the future. But it was very important. So important that Rakefet writes about himself and his wife in Russia working for the Mossad. Big deal. Everyone tells lies. But the Mossad put out a book, Retiv HaDmama, Makar Shazan. And you'll see the stars of the book. When we walked in for the book launch, everyone jumped on us. Atama kol chavim. I didn't know what they talk. What am I, a star? Kol chav, Stella? Stella Dior? Stella Dior cookies? I didn't know what they're talking about. And then we read the book, and we talked to the stars of the book, the little kids from the Bronx. So these two chapters are more about Russia. And I felt very bad, because it's about people in Russia who played a very big role in the 80s. They risked their lives, and they're forgotten. So I was very mockpit to put in these two chapters now. They shouldn't be forgotten in the dustbin of history. You follow? Then I have some pictures on Yeshiva University with identification, which I can't go into in public yet, the one I told you about, but there's more. And then I have some of the articles I've published since Rakefet are in Volume 2. So it's going to be a very big volume. To publish it, the money is already there. There are two major dedications already, one a student, one a classmate. But all right, I'm doing what I can. I can't, Ribbono Shel Olam, Rabbi Miller said to me, I can't conceive that I'll still be teaching at your age. You understand? That was just a few weeks ago. Rabbi David Miller. And so, Baruch Hashem, Ani Modeh LaKadosh Baruch Hu, I thank you for your very kind words. And I hope the students gained out of my lecture. Now, maybe there's a student here who is a Talmud Chacham and has a feeling of trying to achieve something, who will undertake to do a PhD thesis on Rabbi Revel, on Rabbi Belkin. You understand? To me, that is so important. But you have to, the sooner someone gets involved, whatever the reasons are, I was closer to Rabbi Belkin than any other student in the 60s. It's nothing to do with me. Kaliyakiyat, certain things happened. He was very distant from the student body at that time. He was overwhelmed by the problems of funding the yeshiva, etc., etc. I would like to guide the student, because people, I can write about Dr. Belkin. You know, he was drinking coffee, liquor, smoking. The burden of yeshiva overwhelmed him in the 60s. I would tell a student how to write that. You have to write the truth, but you have to know how to write it in a nice way. The burden of yeshiva overwhelmed him. And I have certain stories and insights in Rabbi Belkin's personality. I'll entertain you for one more minute. If you want a little bit of an insight into the difference between the Shmuel Belkin and the Rav, it's very simple. The Rav was a harmonious personality. We never felt the conflict between Torah and Western civilization. You went to college. Am I telling it as it is? All right, Rabbi Blau agrees with me. And believe me, he owes me nothing. He's not agreeing with me because I'm going to give him a lollipop. But that was the rub. Dr. Belkin was a schizophrenic individual. On one hand, he was the Litvashi yeshiva boy. And an hour later, he was president of Yeshiva University, where he had to deal with Albert Einstein. Not just the medical school, but Albert Einstein in person. And I can tell you, it was unbelievable. The man lived in two worlds. When in the 1960s, these stories go, 1960s, a guy named Rogozin gave $1 million to the yeshiva. Rabbis don't have enough ethics. Rabbi, right away, the millionaire finds fault with the rabbis. So they established the Rogozin Institute, 68, it's 1968. They chose 10 scholars, headed up by Rabbi Lichtenstein, and by Professor Isidore Twesky, and we're going to do essays on ethics. And we're promised $1,000 for the first essay. Heavy money, 1968 money. And I'm assigned the topic, Din of the Malchut, the dinner. And I'm under tremendous pressure because my wife has told me we're going in Aliyah. If I don't come, I can stay behind, but that's it. So I want to go in Aliyah with my wife and children, but I want to finish. I need every cent. So I do this work on Din of the Malchut, the dinner. I'm the first one to finish. Now I have to present it to the other 10. In addition, who is sitting there? The multimillionaire giving the money, and of course, if he's sitting there, they have to be Mechaber him, the Rav, and Rabbi Belkin. And it's Din of the Malchut, and then I did the research. When I do the research on that topic, I'm the biggest expert in that room, right or wrong. So the Rav, we're talking, Dr. Belkin suddenly starts throwing out sources, the Mishnah Lemelech, the Kesef Mishnah, the Rishai is quoting Shufa. You couldn't believe the knowledge. Out of nowhere, I turned him on. You follow? At that moment, he was that little Litvisha kid learning in Rotten. And at other times, he went back. He was the president. The Rav, you never felt a dichotomy. It was a total harmonious intellect living experience. With the work on Rogozin, there's a postscript to the story. Finished the work, and they made some suggestions, so now I have, like anything, when you do a master's or you do a doctorate, you all know that you have to correct a few things. That's part of having a committee guiding you. So now I have to correct, so I tell Professor Twesky, who was in charge, I say, Yitzchak, I'm going in Aliyah, I need every cent. He writes a check for $750 and gives it to me. I give in the corrected form. You can all read it. It was published many times in Tradition. Afterwards, Rakafaron Chelik Aleph. It was republished in Florida by the Aleph Institute. It was published in South Africa. You have no idea how far that piece of work went on. But within the year, Yitzchak comes to Israel, and where is he davening? In my shul. He was staying right nearby with some conference at Hebrew U. So we're davening an old Rivka. I think then I was davening the 630 minyan, not today, davening 530 minyan. And he's davening at the minyan. I say, Yitzchak, how are you? He says to me, you should know, you're the only one who got any money out of the Rogozin Institute. What happened? Go back, Google 1969, the stock market crash. Rogozin lost a fortune of money. The pledge he made was never paid. No one else got paid a penny. I'm the only one who walked away with $750. So I told Yitzchak it was a schut of going in Aliyah. He agreed with me, Baruch Hashem. Gentlemen, a great pleasure in doing meet again in health and happiness. Das Vidanya. And if you don't know what that means, I'm going to be very upset because that's the second greatest miracle in modern times. The state of Israel, which includes that we actually have an army, that we have a chain of command, that soldiers who are Jewish can take orders, that when my son-in-law, my eldest son-in-law got out of the car, my wife fainted, all the soldiers looked at what he had on his shoulder and saluted him. Jews saluted him. It's the first miracle. The second miracle, that the Russian Jews are rejoining the Jewish people. Don't minimize that miracle. We're talking over a million souls, and there can be many more. Malk and I were just back in Russia, and we see what's going on. We couldn't believe the sights. But we'll leave that for another time, and therefore I say, Das Vidanya. Thank you very, very much.
Eric Olson, who was a student 20 years ago. But I saw him.